Hello, and welcome to The Mind of a Therapist, a podcast where I interview psychotherapists and helping professionals in what they're passionate about in order to provide you with messages of encouragement and hope. I'm your host, Andrew Earle. The Mind of a Therapist is sponsored by Psychological Counseling Services, healing hearts and transforming lives. Look into our intensive at pcsrl.com. In today's interview, I interview Doug Braun Harvey. Doug's a sexual health author, trainer, and psychotherapist who bridges sexual and mental health and facilitates organizational change. He teaches and trains nationally and internationally, linking sexual health principles within drug and alcohol treatment, group psychotherapy, HIV prevention and treatment, and child maltreatment. So without further ado, here's my interview with Doug. Doug, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being here today. To get going, I like to ask the therapists who are on here this first question of how do you view change as happening? What's necessary for change to happen?
Well, you know, what changed my life as a professional, Andrew, truly changed my perspective in working as a clinician was in the 80s, when new research was coming out of Australia and other places around actually studying the human change process. And out of these studies came an actual kind of model for how people change. It's called the stages of readiness for change. And then it was adapted into a process of actually interacting with clients in a change process by training the therapist to ask and interact with the client in a way that is matched with the client's readiness for change. And what we've really understood is that therapists were messing up. They were trying to apply sound clinical techniques when it wasn't well matched with where the client was at their stage of readiness for change. An idea that changed our entire profession. And I have never looked back and never thought differently in my entire career as a therapist since I learned that information. Even the model that we're here to talk a bit about today with out of control sexual behavior is fundamentally founded within the principles of the stages of change and motivational interviewing techniques for therapists. So that was a profound development in my clinical development. And I'm glad to say that those ideas, that research, those studies, not only became a new and exciting thing for me to learn about, but have become an industry stalwart in the training of therapists throughout the world. So it's an idea that changed the planet as to how we think about how to work with people who want to change their lives.
Absolutely. And some of our listeners will be familiar with these stages of change. Some are not therapists. Will you explain what these stages are?
The most important thing about the stages of readiness for change is that it includes, in the stages, it includes every single stage of change. So that means the first stage of change is called pre-contemplative. And that's the stage of change when you have no interest in changing. That's a real gift of this model, that we all start by not wanting to change. And then we become ambivalent. Then we become a little what they call contemplative, where we're sort of interested in, like, I don't know, maybe there's something about the way I currently do things that isn't so great. That's called contemplation. One of the great gifts of this model is that it taught therapists to honor the stage of contemplation rather than to think of it as something to get over. That it's actually an essential part of preparing for change is to contemplate change long before you actually change. And then the preparation stage of change is people who successfully change have to prepare to change. You don't just change. You have to get your ducks in a row. You got to get some knowledge. You got to figure out how it works. You got to know other people who've made similar changes. And all this is done before stage four, which is the action stage, which actually you're actually doing things to change. Too often people don't think change matters until you're actually at the action stage. Everything else is, people who are wishy-washy, can't make up their mind, not motivated. They have all these judgments. And so the gift of this model is to take the judgments out of these preliminary stages of change that actually are part of change. And then the after action stage is the maintenance stage, where you're maintaining the change. And I think the most important gift of this model around that stage of change is the skills we need to sustain and maintain a change are very different than the skills we needed to actually make the change in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I appreciate this model because like you said, we often just think of the action phase of being what change is, but there's, you know, that piece of pre-contemplation and contemplation, and, you know, this, there's often a dilemma of change, right? There's something at risk for changing. And so that this model resonates with me for sure. And I'd like to get into a bit of your work here with, I know you've been in what the field of what's generally called sex addiction, but you've really shifted in language and your understandings around sex addiction. You use the terms out of control sexual behavior, and I'd be interested to hear about why that differentiation in language is so important for you.
Well, I think the important distinction is when you use the phrase sex addiction, or the other competing phrase that's quite prominent is compulsive sexual behavior. Mm-hmm. Both of these terms were developed out of a medical diagnostic model, meaning that a sex addiction or compulsive sexual behavior, now compulsive sexual behavior disorder, which is the newer classification, are seen as diseases, disorders, pathology, syndromes, addictive disorders. They're seen as crossing the threshold into a state of pathology. Whereas I did not believe that most of the behaviors that were being assessed and diagnosed as a state of pathology were actually sexual problems. Mm. And that we had no way of really conceptualizing and describing and having models of change for people who didn't fit a diagnostic label, that it was premature to apply the diagnostic label, and their sexual behavior would never maybe meet those diagnostic criteria. And that was a real absence in the field. And so I never used the term sex addiction as my theoretical model of working. I was always interested in how do we help people change who aren't necessarily identifying with a state of pathology or disorder. I tried out different ideas over the years, but it was in the early 2000s that John Bancroft, eminent sexologist from the United Kingdom, did some research on this human behavior. He recommended that we use the phrase out of control sexual behavior until we have much better science to differentiate. Excuse me, I got a little something in my throat. That he recommended using the term out of control sexual behavior as a non-descriptive or conclusionary term, that a non-evaluative term and a non-diagnostic term, to just describe the behavior until we have much better science to differentiate between pathological states of sexual behavior and problematic stages of or places of sexual behavior. So that was my entree into using that term. And so John Bancroft and his research really was where that phrase came from. And I've used it ever since.
Yeah. And I appreciate that shift from the language of disorder. I mean, even with like post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, you know, I'm reading the book Change by Edith Eger. She's a Holocaust survivor. And, you know, to say that it's disordered to have experienced trauma and ramifications of trauma is a bit odd. And so I appreciate that shift from pathology to a behavior that seems out of control for this person.
Right. And then after Bancroft myself, and I was working at that time in collaboration with Michael Vigorito and further developing the model, both Michael and I agreed that this was the term we wanted to use moving forward. And it was then when we wrote our book in the mid, about around 2015 is when we worked very, very long on writing that book that was published in late 2015 and 2016. We, because of writing and presenting on this topic for many years, Mike and I collaborated on creating a definition for out of control sexual behavior. Our definition is when an individual's consensual sexual urges, thoughts, and behaviors. First of all, OCSB is a sexual health problem. It's a sexual health problem in which a person's sexual urges, thoughts, and behaviors feel out of control to the person themselves.
Yes. And I appreciate the inclusion of the consensual piece, because I think that that's an important part of this conversation. Will you talk more about sexual health? I know that I've heard you talk about the six principles of sexual health. Will you run through those for our listeners?
Well, let me, before I describe the principles, let me describe how what I'm saying fits into the idea of out of control sexual behavior as a sexual health problem.
Yeah.
A sexual health problem in this context is that the behavior of a person is out of alignment with some fundamental ideas of what it means to have sexual health. Now, one of the important things about a sexual health conceptualization, it's not based on specific sexual acts. So sexual health is a concept that doesn't describe which body part goes in which orifice, with which person, at what time, and under what cultural and environmental circumstances. That's not the conceptualization of sexual health. It's not an act-centered definition. It's a principle-centered definition. There are principles, there are ideas, larger aspirations related to sexual health.
Yeah.
And so sexual health is a conceptual aspiration. So I think that's important to hear before jumping into the more specifics.
Yeah.
The sexual health has been defined differently over the years. The sexual health first became defined more broadly after the science development of effective contraception within the mid to late 60s in the United States and around the world, when sex no longer was so preoccupied with preventing or wanting to have sex lead to procreation, that freed up for us to think about other aspects of sexuality and what it's about. And that's where the whole idea of sexual health expanded beyond just preventing a pregnancy when you don't want one, or preventing an unplanned pregnancy, or acquiring a sexually transmitted infection. When those two things were no longer the preoccupation with fundamental sexual health, people looked around and said, well, what else is there to sexual health? And so sexual health really expanded from the World Health the World Health Organization definition in 1975, and then other definitions. So I'm going to talk specifically about a definition from the year 2000 from the Pan American Health Association, which expanded on sexual health from the basic idea of sexual health being a balance between safety and pleasure. That's really the fundamental kernel of what we mean by sexual health. It's a balance between the competing fundamental issues that are present in a sexual life. We need to have safety in our sexual lives, and we need to have pleasure. They're both important. And so sexual health is when sexuality, sexual behavior is being discussed and prioritizing in a very similar way how much safety is present in the sex and how much pleasure is present in the sex. Most in the United States, most people are comfortable talking about sex only about when it's about harm, or when there's a lack of safety, or when there's danger, or when there's something unwanted to happen, or there's something judged about how a person is behaving sexually. These are areas where our culture can discuss sexuality more openly. As soon as you include pleasure in the occasion, in the equation, sexuality is far more difficult to talk about in our culture. And so a sexual health focus balances safety and pleasure. So that's an important fundamental idea. And then the six principles came out of this 2000 definition of sexual health, where they looked at responsible sexual behavior. And out of that, I don't have all the words in front of me, but out of that definition, I noticed there were six ideas in that definition that really stood out as pretty basic to sexual health, really basic. So I thought, well, maybe one of the dilemmas with sexual health and people understanding sexual health is we're making it too complicated. We're making it too comprehensive, maybe too abstract, you know? And so I thought, well, let's simplify this to give people, you know, specific, clear ideas of things they can do to improve their sexual health. And that's where these six principles come from. So the six principles of sexual health, the first one is consent. I mean, that may sound ridiculous. What do you mean consent is a sexual health principle? Well, you know, if people understood the importance of consent in sex, you know, there'd be a whole lot of other sexual health problems we wouldn't have on the planet.
Yes.
So consent is still fundamental and a basic piece of information. And then a non-exploitation, which is, you know, dealing with power differentials in human relationships and how people will exploit a power differential between one person and another to gain access to that person or a situation to have sexual activity. So it's a use of power to gain access to sex, which is different than non-consent, which is about a forced activity, a violation of bodily integrity, a forced situation. So oftentimes if exploitation doesn't work to get access to sex, some people then resort to non-consent and use force and violence or threats of violence to gain access to sex. So there's consent, non-exploitation, and then there's two of the more subjective aspects of sexual health, which is honesty and shared values. You know, so we're really looking at, you know, how honest can one be about their sexual lives with others? And then the values are the values that why I have sex and what's meaningful for me about sex, how close are those values with the people I'm involved with sexually? And then the last two sexual health principles really are, you know, the things we really think about but don't want to think about, and that's unplanned, unwanted pregnancies, sexually transmitted infections, HIV. We want to protect from these sort of negative sexual health outcomes whenever possible. And the last sexual health principle is pleasure. And so you can see even within the principles, there's these safety dimensions and there's pleasure. So a sexual health always has to include the tension, the unavoidable tension between safety and pleasure as it relates to sexual interaction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to ask when you were talking about that balance between safety and pleasure, if you could talk more about safety but in these first, five principles, you know, we really see more specifics about what the safety piece looks like, the consent, not exploiting, not threatening others, you know, not using power.
Yes, that's right.
Being safe when we're sexually active.
Right. And safety means far much more than, you know, from the 1980s and the HIV epidemic, where it was this idea of safe sex moved into the national language.
Yeah.
And so if too often safety is only really associated with, you know, a negative sexual outcome in typically HIV or a sexually transmitted infection. We don't even call an unwanted or unplanned pregnancy unsafe sex. So there has to be a literally the presence of a most likely a consequence that could lead to death related to sex that I guess made it possible to put the word safe in. That's a very narrow idea of what we mean by safety.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, and Doug, you know, a lot of, I imagine a lot of some of the listeners listening to this may identify with, sex addiction that fits for them. You know, and, you know, people be at various stages of, you know, healing relationships. There may have just been a discovery about their you know, sexual behaviors. What sort of message would you have for that person? What do you think is most important for them to know?
Well, a couple of things that I've seen over the years. First and foremost, is there are tremendous forces at work that work against a person reevaluating their identity as having porn or sex addiction. The number of men I've talked to who have reconsidered that idea face tremendous barriers to reconsidering that idea that I have a sex or a porn addiction.
Yeah.
It's as if once that identity, once that diagnosis, once that conceptualization of my sexual behavior problem as an addiction is set, it's almost inviolable to reconsider or change that idea. It's not a welcomed notion for most people. So what I end up talking about instead is that we suffer from a huge sexual problem in the country, and it's premature evaluation. That we prematurely and quite confidently encourage people, once the minute they identify they may feel sexually out of control, or they've had disclosures of sexual behavior that have been betraying or injurious or harmful or emotionally, disgusting to somebody else, that there's little to no space for discussion about and just contemplating all these behaviors. There is an enormous movement and almost a demand to label and characterize what to call this behavior. And by far the most prominent characterization, in which there is tremendous pressure to immediately apply to characterize the behavior, is sex addiction. Mm-hmm. Now, it serves many functions in those moments in early months or even years of coming to terms with this behavior. There's many functions that the sex addiction identity serves, but because it serves a function doesn't mean it's an accurate conclusion. Mm-hmm.
And what do you see as ramifications of the sex addiction understanding in persons' lives?
Tell me what you mean by ramification.
I'm curious what sort of effects you've seen it have, if you have, of one identifying as a sex addict, as you were talking about.
For some people, it saves their lives. Mm. For some people, it saves their relationships with people they love the most in the world.
Yeah.
For some people, it gives them a way to organize something that they feel deep shame and terror about being involved with. So it has, and that's just to name a few.
Yeah.
One of the more important things the sex addiction identity provides very early on for people is hope. There's this clear tasks, there's these clear things you do, there's a ready-made community of people. You walk into a room and people are interested in hearing your experience. Those are incredibly compelling functions for maintaining this identity. But as we're finding, there are people who, or even enter treatment programs. If you identify as a sex addict, you have a whole treatment industry available to you that are people that want to help you and the people are interested in you. That's very compelling. Mm. One of the things I like to say about particularly men's sexual health, and this is a intentionally gendered idea, that I think we live in a country that is fairly uninterested in men's sexual health. Until they injure somebody, or they are injured themselves, or they identify as a sex addict, then we're interested in men's sexual health. Mm. Other than that, men are kind of on their own.
Yeah.
And so the sex addiction identity also is one of the few avenues men can move into a community that is interested in their sexual health. Men are so alone with their sexual health.
And Doug, I'd be curious to hear ideas you have around how we might, as individuals, as organizations and societies, as a society, support men in having these contexts to talk about their sexual health.
Well, we have a long way to go.
Yeah.
All I can say is these six principles of sexual health, since I first identified these in like 2001, because the definition came out in 2000, I have been struck by the resonance these six ideas have cross-culturally, internationally on other continents, and different languages, that there's something here that it and I don't want to make it overly simplified here, but they're concrete enough to give people an idea of how to orient themselves, how to just even get started with thinking about sexual health. So these principles are set up like, let's get these six ducks in a row first and then worry about everything else. Mm-hmm. They're fundamental. And that seems to be a way in for men. And I'm going to speak to men because that's primarily who I've been working with. But I hear this from, it doesn't matter the gender identity or the gender spectrum in which a person identifies themselves. The principles seem to resonate. So I think that's one thing, is we need to start the conversation with a doable set of information that people feel like they can do something with it. It's not too abstract. It's not too big of an idea. It doesn't sound too heady and academic. And my anecdotal experience over the last several decades has been these sexual health principles just resonate as soon as people hear them.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm grateful because these principles are so clear, and like you said, it's curious how there's not much I'm grateful you included the pleasure piece, because it is so curious how there's not much discussion about sexual pleasure in our society.
Well, I just want to do a little language correction here. Mm. I didn't include pleasure. The World Health Organization included pleasure. I harvested from ideas that come from international bodies throughout the globe who said sexual health has to include pleasure, not just safety. So this is not my idea. And even these six principles were harvested from a larger definition of sexual health. So the one thing I did to sort of harvest these ideas and call them principles of sexual health and promote them as principles of sexual health, that is my work. But I rest on shoulders of many, many people.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yeah, sorry, misspoke with the language there, the harvesting and presenting this information.
Yeah.
Yeah. Will you talk more about your sense of why there's so little discussion about sexual pleasure in our society? You know, what it just seems so foreign for most people to talk about what specifically brings them sexual pleasure in our society. I mean, even talking about sex is quite taboo.
Well, you know, I that's a kind of a big, broad anthropological question, and it's not really my area of expertise. What I can say to you is what I've experienced in groups talking with men for 30 years. That's can be my data set.
Yeah.
You know, I did group therapy for 30 years with men who were feeling sexually out of control. Mm-hmm. And what I saw over and over and over again was that actually men were talking about pleasure. Except where they were talking about it and how they were talking about it ended up in shame, betrayal, engaging in things that cross their values. In other words, people are looking for places to figure out what is pleasurable for them sexually. People are doing this all the time, every day. It's constantly part of how they're understanding themselves as being human. Mm. We just live in a space in which to talk about pleasure is to risk shunning, shame, judgment, ridicule, lack of language, feeling embarrassed. In our culture, I've seen this quite often, when somebody tries to attempt to talk about their sources of pleasure, what erotically pleases them, what they fantasize about, the kind of sexual acts they've engaged in that they find particularly deeply pleasurable. Excuse me, I'm gonna clear my throat. That they tend to be responded to with judgment.
Yeah.
And we live in a culture that does not judge the people who judge people's sexual behavior. In our culture, you get to judge people for what they do sexually. And nobody looks at you and said, hey, knock it off. Stop judging them. That's only begun to change. Hmm. So until these harsh, ridiculing, disdainful judgments leveled at people who are in some ways trying to figure out this balance between safety and pleasure, if we can start honoring the quest instead of judging their ill-advised attempts, I think we'd have sexual health conversations more frequently.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and I'm curious what messages you have for therapists, maybe therapists who the sex addiction model has fit for them, and they treat sex addicts. What's the biggest message that you'd want to relay to that practitioner?
I've got several.
Uh-huh.
This is my most significant disagreement with the entire field of dealing with diagnosing sexual behavior disorders. And that's that the field has not made a clear distinction between people who cross and violate the non-consent boundary. The sex addiction field puts the non-consenters and the consenters together.
Wow.
Now they do make some distinctions. I've talked with various sex addiction professionals about this distinction. There seems to be an idea that what they call non-contact offenses, where somebody engages in non-consensual sexual activity, but it doesn't involve forced contact with another body, skin to skin. So for example, somebody might expose themselves non-consensually to another person in nudity or their penis is erect. Or somebody might be a voyeur and non-consensually observing people having sexual activity. These are non-consensual sex acts. Frauderism, where somebody is non-consensually making physical contact with another person in public or nondescript places. So, I once worked with a guy who was a hairdresser, and he would press his pelvis area against his female people he was cutting their hair, and then gain an erection, and wait to see if the female client had any reaction to experiencing the pressure or feeling his erect penis against their body. This was his peak erotic turn on. So the sex addiction field would probably, for the most part, see all of these people as being sex addicts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but it's not just the sex addiction field, compulsive sexual behavior, the whole idea of hypersexuality. There's been so many different conceptualizations that have been vying for a kind of way of understanding this diagnostically, but none of the diagnostic entities that have been created have taken a stand in a clear position around, does this diagnosis apply to non-consensual, violent forced sex, or even coercive, coarse sexual behaviors? Where is the line been when we're going to consider those behaviors a kind of a different sort of notion than that their sexual life has become an addictive process is the explanation. So the out of control sexual behavior model that I work with is only for consensual behavior.
Yeah.
if somebody is involved in non-consensual sex as a pattern of their feeling out of control, I want them assessed by a specialist who works with non-consensual behavior and can get them the kind of treatment that they may need. So I really hold the whole field accountable to that. And that's a really big one. Secondly, is again, I think the sex addiction field, the compulsive sexual behavior field, the compulsive sexual behavior disorder field, except I'm going to make a caveat at that the World Health Organization's newest classification of compulsive sexual behavior disorder, which will actually become effective January 1st of 2022. That's how new this is going to be on the planet. I'll get to that in a minute. But all the other previous attempts for diagnostic criteria have not been very good at making clear who's not eligible for the diagnosis. And even though they feel out of control. So this space between just having typical worries about sex, like we all do, you know, do my underarms smell today while I'm having sex? Whatever, sure. we all have worries when we have sex. But there's this space between a worry and a disorder. And those are problems.
Yeah.
And the sex addiction model has really done from, and I've read, I can't tell you the number of stuff I've read. I don't hear an emphasis or even creating a model of care when you have a problem, not an addiction.
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. And,
so that's why that's the space my model of out of control sexual behavior really is attempting, the sexual health model is attempting to address, is the wide range of people who have problems with feeling sexually out of control without reaching a threshold of diagnosis and disorder.
Sure. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. And how about for clinicians that are more general practitioners, don't specialize, aren't sexologists or work in the field of sex addiction? What's in light of your work, what's a message that you have for them?
Well, I can include the sex addiction professionals in this because this was going to be my third point for the sex addiction professionals as well. The mental health field in general is a fairly sexually illiterate profession. You can become a licensed psychologist. You can become a licensed psychotherapist, marriage and family therapist, social worker, licensed professional counselor, all the different ways in which mental health professionals are licensed by states in order to profession to provide psychotherapy. Almost all of these people have gotten their degree, their training, their internship, their licensure exam, all of that they've been able to acquire to become and call themselves a licensed therapist. And very few of them were required to even have one course in human sexuality.
Yeah.
So that's really stunning when you think of the number of times people bring their sexual lives to psychotherapy, that is a profession. The sexual lives of clients is an incredibly undereducated aspect of every client that's sitting in front of the therapist.
Yeah.
Undereducated part of the therapist who's sitting in front of the client. And so the sex addiction field, of course, primarily is overseen by people certified to provide sex addiction therapy. They're certified sex addiction therapists. And the entire certification sex addiction therapy process does not require a significant training in human sexuality. It's a trauma model. It's a addictive model. It's a sexual behavior model. But it doesn't really have rigor in requiring everybody who has that certification to have the kind of training that people who are certified sex therapists or people who have a specialization in sex therapy or people who had enormous amount of coursework or education in sexuality, that doesn't exist in the certified sex addiction minimal standards.
Sure.
And so that's true for the mental health field in general. So both certified sex addiction therapists and the general therapy field in general. So if somebody's, you know, feeling like, geez, I don't know what to do with these folks that have, you know, I think they're out of control sexually, go and get some coursework in human sexuality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, you need to get continuing education to renew your license. What if you were to spend the next 4 years, all of your continuing education was going to be based on sexuality training and learning how to be comfortable and competent and capable of willing to talk about the sexuality of your clients. And here's the number one pattern we know in the mental health field. There's plenty of data to support this. This is not my opinion. But in the mental health field, the pattern is what the more a therapist is uncomfortable talking about sexuality, lack of training, has no supervision that expects them to talk about it. There's just little no support or any knowledge about human sexuality. The more they fit into that mold, the more the pattern is that the therapist avoids bringing up sex until the client brings it up. That pattern has been observed time and time again. It is a research-based observation.
Absolutely. And Doug, we're getting to the end of the hour. I think that this is a good segue here as clinicians who would be listening and you know, listeners of ours who aren't clinicians would be interested in learning more. Will you tell people how to get in contact with you, with your work, with your publications and books?
Well, I think the first thing is I do have a company that I've created with my partner, Al Killen Harvey. We call it the Harvey Institute. And the Harvey Institute is committed to the integration of sexual health to improve healthcare outcomes. And so this is our work. If at the Harvey Institute, all you have to do is Google the Harvey Institute. You'll get our webpage. It'll be the first hit that comes up. And on our webpage, you can find many, many podcasts such as this one. You can find online training opportunities that I have recorded and offer as training to therapists specifically dealing with out of control sexual behavior. And you can find the three books referenced there. My first two books dealt with sexual health in drug and alcohol treatment, specifically the substance abuse and addiction treatment field is a fairly avoidant field of dealing with the sexual lives of people that come to treatment for substance abuse problems. Oftentimes people who have sexual behaviors and addiction treatment are called sex addicts. That's the language in the field. You're in a drug treatment program and somebody has sexual behavior problems, they're just called, they're a sex addict. So we talk about premature evaluation. My first two books were on dealing with specifically the issues of helping the substance use and abuse and treatment field address what I call sex drug linked behavior rather than and not call them sex addicts. And then my third book is Treating Out of Control Sexual Behavior, Rethinking Sex Addiction, which is the sexual health model that we began to just talk briefly about here together today. And all three of those books you can find information about at the website, theharveyinstitute.com.
Great. Well, thank you for that, Doug. And the question I like to end the episode with is what's a message of hope that you have for the listener today?
That men know how to do this. Men know how and want to learn how to have meaningful sexual health conversations. They really do. And men can do this. And we give up on men because we don't know and believe they want to and care about having meaningful sexual health conversations.
Yeah. Well, that's a great note to end on. Doug, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Thanks for being on the podcast today.
You're welcome.
Please press the subscribe button, as well as rating and reviewing our podcast. This helps others connect with what you've been hearing. If you have any questions, please contact us at themindofatherapist@gmail.com. These questions will be kept anonymous. I want to thank Eric Price for the wonderful music you hear in this podcast. Additionally, this podcast was created to provide accurate and authoritative information on the subject matter. Although we are interviewing licensed therapists, they are not your therapists. This podcast is not intended to serve as direct medical advice and should not be used as a substitute for direct professional help. It is given with the understanding that neither the host, publisher, guests, or PCS are rendering legal, clinical, clinical or other professional information. If you need a professional, we encourage you to find one. Visit Psychology Today to connect with a licensed clinician near you.